Hello and welcome back to Romaniacs, where we try to build a better bridge to Europe than the one Boris Johnson wants to make from old bits of Meccano and fake non-European Lego. My name's Peter Collins, and we've got a full complement of self-obsessed, unpatriotic malcontents on the show this week. Naomi Smith, first of all, is a former Lib Dem parliamentary candidate. She's now Executive Director for Campaigns at London First, where she concentrates on housing, skills, immigration, and of course Brexit. And a quick disclaimer here, all panellists, when they appear on the programme, are just expressing their own opinions, not their bosses. So, hello Naomi, how excited are you about this round of speeches and the relaunch of the government's Brexit policy?
Well, we are recording this on Valentine's Day. I found out today from YouGov profiles that Liberal Democrat voters are the most likely to say that they like Valentine's Day, whereas Tories are the most likely to say they dislike the Day of Love because they have hearts of stone, Peter. however, Boris Johnson has kicked off this set of speeches today. We'll be talking more about that later. But I have to say that when it was trailed as his exercise in whispering sweet nothings into the ears of Remainers, in all honesty, that made me want to concrete over every orifice of my body so that he couldn't possibly whisper anything in anywhere.
What a thought. We'll be looking at that in more detail later. Also with us is Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, alias Angry of Belsize Park, and a regular pundit on Sky and BBC News. You may have seen him lately clashing with the former Labour MP and Leave campaigner Gisela Stewart over the Irish border question and, of course, winning. Hello, Ian. I understand you were originally quite a fan of Gisela Stewart some while back. What happened? What went wrong?
I still think she's probably in the better category, really. I probably have a fondness for some Brexiters that a lot of people that listen to this would just think were just completely off the scale. I mean, when you spend most of your time debating against these people, you do notice when there's like an extra level of intellectual content to the stuff that's being presented you to. So the last time I had to go sort of do a debate against Daniel Hannan, I said nice things about him online and spent the next 2 hours of my life just having a wave of, how can you say it? But obviously you do, because there is content there and there is some awareness there, unlike just the get over it sort of tribe, which constitutes about 70%. She's all right. She's not so bad.
But in that talk, she seemed to be pretty flummoxed by the issue of the Irish border. You didn't have any problem pointing out that she wasn't really making much sense. Why she got all that wrong then?
Oh, because she's still a Brexiter. I mean, you know, so they're still at this point where they need to, they cannot say that the border will close up. You know, they cannot admit that. But at the same time, they must say that we're leaving the customs union. So they're in an impossible, you know, Merlin position that they've invented themselves. And there's no way of justifying it. She could have, you know, the biggest brain in the world. She still wouldn't be able to justify that position because it's objectively impossible. You know, it's almost not her fault, except that she has decided to hold that position in the first place. But having held it, she couldn't have done any better than she did.
Well, I hope she appreciates how nice you're being to her. Completing our treacherous trio today is Roz Taylor, research manager of the LSE's Truth, Trust and Technology Commission, and general Brexit wonk, pundit, aficionado and maven. Which of those do you prefer, Roz?
Maven.
It's a good word,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Maven.
It's a Yiddish word from picked up in the United States. Lovely word. So there was a piece on the excellent LSE Brexit blogs this week, which you're also associated with, which was written by a former colleague of mine at The Economist, Philippe Legrand, saying that our best bet is not to have a Norway deal or a Canada deal, but to be like Jersey. How would that work?
Yeah, this is a bit optimistic. I was a bit. This piece, basically, he's saying that we can't be like Norway because we don't want freedom of movement. If we're going to stay and continue to have the benefits of, you know, some of the things that the customs union is good for, we could kind of do that by being like Jersey and have a customs union with the EU. You will remember that a week or two ago, Theresa May's spokesman explicitly ruled out being in the customs union, a customs union. Mm-hmm. So really, he's being a bit optimistic here, in my view. But the idea is that we could be, it could all be tariff free. Mm-hmm. Having said that, he then goes on to explain a lot of other things which would have to happen for this to still work. We would have to avoid a customs border. We would have to keep all our standards and regulations in order to trade freely with mm-hmm. the EU, which, as you know, we apparently don't want to do. And so we'd have to remain in the EU's VAT system. It goes on and on. But you know, it's a thought. It's another one to throw into the mix that we haven't heard before. before. We've got Switzerland, we've got Norway now, Jersey. It just goes on and on.
Well, of course, Jersey's best known for tax-free savings, new potatoes, cream, Bergerac, and for older listeners, Alan Wicker. So the idea is that the whole of Britain becomes Wicker Island, like the Monty Python
sketch.
You've
still not made a single cultural reference the whole time we've done this podcast that I actually know.
Mutual exclusivity thing. I never understand the ones that you make about comic books and things. But anyway, someone out there in the listenership will get this. So on the show this week, what's going on with that Brexit relaunch by the government? The key Brexiters in the cabinet are all making supposedly landmark speeches, but Brexo-skeptic Philip Hammond isn't. John McDonnell says that when Labour renationalise everything and bring back British Rail, British Leyland, the Gas Board and possibly Green Shield stamps, you won't remember those, Ian, it won't cost anything. How would that work in the straitened circumstances of post-Brexit Britain? Also, after years of dipping its toes into conspiracy theory, the pro-Brexit press finally went full tinfoil and added the financier George Soros to the ever-lengthening list of enemies of the people. Is the paper's monstering of Soros as nasty and anti-Semitic as it appears? And do people really understand who Soros is and what he does? Also, Christmas has come early for Ian, because later in the show we've got All You Need to Know About Tariffs, which I think is one of those Oasis songs that sounds like the Beatles wrote it. Anyway, the tariffs are very important. They're at the heart of future trade policy. Nobody except Ian apparently understands what they mean, and we'll explain them.
I just want to point out, I didn't even propose that we do tariffs. Someone else did it. Oh. It was the most remarkable. I have no idea who came up with this idea.
So anyway, here's Roz with some quick announcements first.
We are deep in rehearsals for the first Romaniacs Live on Thursday, 22nd of February. Ian will be flying above the crowd on a wire, and Peter will perform an extended 8-minute solo on financial passporting regulations. Mm-hmm. As regular listeners know, our first live show sold out in just a few days. So if you want tickets for the next Romaniacs Live, the best way to do it is to back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Pledge a few pounds a month and you will get first dibs on tickets, plus those sought-after Romaniacs T-shirts, mugs and bags will be yours. Find out more at romaniacs.com. And if you're already a Patreon backer, don't forget you can add tunes to our Songs for Europe Spotify list, which will be playing after the show as everyone mingles and chats, as you all will, I'm quite sure. Top marks to Ian Chilvers, who added A Lovely Day Tomorrow by British Sea Power, a cheerful song about the assassination of leading Nazi Reinhard Heydrich by Czech and Slovak partisans in 1942. Setting the tone perfectly there. To find out more, just search Romaniacs Patreon.
So, time to open the tin of hornets that is the Brexit news. First up, that exciting relaunch of Conservative Brexit policy. We're promised no fewer than 6 important speeches over the next 3 weeks, which will set out the government's vision, apparently, for Brexit, the one that we've been waiting for these past 18 months. The key Brexit ultras, Johnson, Fox and Davis, are all speaking. Beleaguered Eurosofty Philip Hammond has been locked away in a cupboard, although Theresa May's pro-EU deputy David Lidington will get to speak. We recorded this show on Wednesday, just after Boris Johnson pushed into the front of the queue and made his speech, apparently reaching out to us, the Remainers, by saying that we should all come together right now, as the Beatles again, because Brexit is, quote, the great liberal project of the age. So, Roz first, did he demonstrate in his speech that Brexit will be the great liberal project of the age?
Yeah, of course he did, Peter. No, geez, this was a terrible speech. It was really, really just really bad on so many levels. And I try to read it with an open mind. But to appeal to people like us, frankly, he brought in John Stuart Mill, the great liberal. Probably just looked him up and thought, John Stuart Mill, let's see. I bet John Stuart Mill would have been a leaver. Well, yeah, that's one take. John Stuart Mill arguably would not. He did have strong views about nation states and what sort of held them together. But he also, which Johnson may not have read, suggested that a federal structure of different states was possible, providing you managed to maintain national characteristics as he saw them, that it wasn't impossible for states to get together. And also, the other thing to bear in mind about Mill is that he was writing in the 19th century in a pre-First and Second World War environment, and how we think about nation states is very different now, because so much has happened since, which is not to negate what Mill has to offer, but it's to say that his viewpoint is a bit more complex than Johnson was perhaps suggesting.
Well, my take on it is that, you know, Brexit means doing less trade and having less cooperation with democratic countries, nice countries like Sweden and the Netherlands, and instead grovelling before all of the human rights abusing regimes in the world, from big ones like Chinese and the Russians to medium-sized ones like Myanmar and Thailand, and trying to make up for all the business we've lost in Europe. We look forward to May and Johnson kowtowing to all of these despots and glossing over their abuses. That's how liberal a project Brexit is to me. Ian.
I have to say, I kind of had a bit of a wobble when he mentioned John Stuart Mill, because I just thought, that is very hard for me to emotionally accept those words coming out of your mouth. And for you to deploy them in this context just filled me with so much rage that I was sort of on the verge of just not even being able to see the screen and just hammering away on the sort of keyboard. His argument broke down into sort of three categories that he wanted to sort of alleviate our concerns about. One of them was geostrategic, the next one was sort of, he called it spiritual aesthetic, and the last one was economic. And on the geostrategic, you know, loss of Britain's status in the world, he basically said, look, we'll still help them with defence, you know, and security, which is just, obviously, in fact, that's actually one of our kind of playing cards in negotiation, is to say, look, we know that countries like Poland are sketching out about Russia, we know that NATO is not as reliable as it used to be because of Trump and all this, so, you know, we still have this to offer. I mean, that's just a strategic advantage. So to deploy it now is, oh, don't worry, we've still got an army, is not something that's particularly convincing. The spiritual aesthetic stuff was just a bunch of mumbo-jumbo garbage, which I suppose was his sort of thing of like, oh, we're not leaving Europe. You know, we're leaving the EU, we're not leaving Europe. We're still part of it. It's like, no one was suggesting that you had the power to move islands, Boris. So, you know.
Complete straw man.
Yes, indeed. And then the last one was the economics. And the economics, I mean, fuck me, it's just a chasm of nothing. It's just, there's nothing to offer. He had so little to offer that the only bit I could guess that actually had content to it was when, at one point, someone asked him a question asking for clarity, and he thought they said carrots. he then proceeded to say, but I'm sure we'll do something good with the regulation on organic carrots. Yeah. And that was, I mean, at the height of his discussion as to the economic consequences of Brexit or trying to alleviate our concerns. So at the end of it, look, I didn't go into it with an open mind. I went into it thinking, this guy's a massive bell end and an absolutely lying, mendacious sod. And I came out of it with the exact same conclusion.
Were you reassured, Naomi?
The low point for me, similar to everybody else, is just his general hijacking of the word liberal. You know, this man is no liberal. Leaving a liberal union like the EU is not a liberal thing to do. Leaving the EU free zone area to a tariff-bound zone under WTO rules is not liberal. Somebody wrote in the New European this week that the EU has no more stopped us trading with China any more than it stopped us waging an illegal war on Iraq. The economics of everything he said was completely delusional. A small highlight for me was when he said, to those who hail me in the street with cheery four-letter epithets, at least they know roughly who I am and roughly what I do. So first off, hats off to those people that shout four-letter epithets at Boris when they manage to see him bumbling around the place. But, you know, no, do they hell know roughly what you do, what you think? They don't. We, you know, Boris will say whatever he thinks is required for his career.
On that point you make, he says, you know, people don't know who their MEP is. Well, most people don't know who their local Westminster MP is. They certainly don't know, or in most cases, who their local councillor is. Mm. The whole speech was shot through with all these non-sequiturs that he was saying, well, you know, what's the, you know, how many people know what a Spitzen candidate is? But, you know, look at Parliament. It's full of huge amounts of jargon about sort of who knows what short money is, what an early day motion is. You know, local councils have all sorts of jargon, ultra vires and so on. What does that prove? The whole thing seemed to me like it wasn't there at all to reassure us as Remainers. Of course not. What it was there is to reassure leavers that they still know what they're doing and that they're still right to be leavers. They're all arguments that, if you're not really paying attention, might sound half plausible. But as soon as you pick them up and start to examine them, they all fall apart. You mentioned another one there, the thing about trade. He mentions that, hey, you know, our trade with the EU hasn't grown very much because it's probably, you know, reaching saturation. But our trade with Saudi Arabia has grown by X percent. Well, doesn't that show that we can still increase our trade with Saudi Arabia without leaving the EU? Again, if you pick up the point that he makes, that's supposedly a pro-Brexit point, it just falls apart in your hands. But if you're not listening, it sounds like he's got a good point.
Yeah. There is a great sort of spiritual moment to this whole thing, really, which is encapsulated by that John Stuart Mill stuff. so that we are seeing the rise of nativism in this country. That is the story of what has taken place over the last 2 years. And in that moment, as you see authoritarian raise its head, you have to make a call about the way that you behave towards that thing. Do you say, I am going to play ball with it, I am going to do whatever is required for me to say in order for this thing to trundle on, or do you try and stand up for it? When we talk about John Stuart Mill, the main thing that he concerned himself about was the tyranny of the majority, of what happens to minority groups when the majority turn against them. And what has happened in this country right now is that immigrants are routinely libeled on a day-by-day basis, inflicted with the most grotesque intrusions into their private life, whether it's a landlord checking their papers or whether it's having the government say that this couple can't live together because one of them doesn't earn enough money, separating families, keeping grandparents from coming over for weddings, even when, and this happens particularly to British Pakistanis, they were born here, were raised here, and still denied that kind of opportunity. And in that kind of setup, for him to come out and go, this is a liberal case, and then to start repeating the nonsense fallacies about immigration reducing wages, and to start pretending that British freedom of movement will continue as it was before, when it most manifestly will not, and the British and Europe group have been making clear to the government over and over and over again that their freedom of movement rights are going, and that affects their businesses and their quality of life in Europe, is just absolute nonsense of the highest order, and it's cowardice and hypocrisy combined in roughly equal ratios.
And for me, that thing you pointed out about immigration and wages was the absolute low light, the lower than a snake's belly part of the speech, where he talks about 20 years of uncontrolled immigration followed by what many see as the consequent suppression of wages. What he means is, I know perfectly well that councillor studies have proved that the immigration from the EU does not appreciably have any effect on wages, but I'm determined to make short use of that falsehood because it suits me right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In other words, deliberately, knowingly, winkingly peddling a falsehood that you absolutely know is false, because it'll be an applause line from your side of the argument.
And at the same time, buttressing your liberal argument by saying how wonderful it was that he claims 400,000, really, the figure is actually debatable, 400,000 French people came to live in London under his mayoralty. Now, that didn't happen. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for freedom of movement. But, of course, those are the good immigrants. Those are the ones we like, who live in South Ken and pay huge taxes. You know, it was just so duplicitous. But for me, for the low point as well, was a short one when he just said, we can fish our own fish. I mean, Jesus. I mean, there may come a time, you know, in the Brexit sunlit uplands when a fish can attain the status of Britishness and can perhaps have a blue fish passport and can know that its destiny is indeed to be fish fingers. But that time has not yet come. And until then, there are no fucking British fish. There are fish that move around between different areas, which we help to control as part of the EU. They are not British. And I just wanted to die when I read that.
Ended with this bit where he sort of said, oh, and once we're out, we won't blame everything on Brussels anymore. He invented the journalistic subgenre of making shit up about the EU. You know, the bending bananas and the God knows what. He basically made that quasi-fictional sort of subgenre. But it suddenly sparked into life Tory Euroscepticism that took us to the referendum. Now, for him to turn around now like some kind of abusive husband and go, oh, I'll stop doing it as soon as you do exactly what I want you to do, is just the most irritating possible ending for that speech. And yet it was the way that he nevertheless chose to do it. I sort of thought at the beginning, when he sort of did this whole, we can't just sit around going, get over it, you know, blah, 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 I thought, 18 months. You've had 18 months. You have done absolutely none of this. You're calling us supine, cowardice, God knows what else you called us in those articles. Then for you to come out now and say, I'm going to make a positive case while not making any policy change whatsoever, not even taking half a step in the direction of those who have concerns, and using arguments that don't even stand up on their own basis upon which they are made, is just, you know, pathetic beyond belief. If there was a single Remainer out there who was convinced by what he said today, I'd be absolutely amazed.
And we've got a whole series of them yet to come. You know, as you just mentioned, we are 18 months in, the pressure's been building. We've been waiting and waiting and waiting to see what this government's Brexit strategy is. And all we've ended up with is a bloody essay writing competition. That's what this feels like, you know. Which one of them is going to be able to put forward the most beautiful version of Brexit for everybody? It's an absolute nonsense. You know, this attempt to set out a strategy isn't that. It's just this, you know, ridiculous essay writing competition, as I say. And I think because, you know, the polls are showing this less favourable message on Brexit, although the Tories seem to be slightly ahead when you take a trend of the most recent polls, they've got a lead over Labour of a couple of points and May has a lead over Corbyn. But when it comes to Brexit, three quarters of voters in this latest BMG poll show that they're unclear about May's strategy. I don't think they're going to be any clearer after these set speeches are finished.
I mean, it has to mean something, doesn't it? The people you rightly listed the people that were making the speeches. You know, like you say, Hammond isn't there. Rudd isn't there. We've got Lidington, who actually is a legit... He's actually a really good Remainer. He really knows his Europe very, very well indeed. But apart from that, I mean, maybe she still doesn't have any idea. But to me, I think I am taking the hint now that when she comes up, eventually, she is eventually going to have to do a policy. I mean, at the moment, it obviously seems more likely than not that it will be the full divergence, which puts us onto the sort of Canada-style deal. Now, that fundamentally changes the dynamics for how things will end up. I'm not sure she can win in the Commons on that basis. But nevertheless, I mean, if you're a betting man, given the people selected for these speeches, that does seem to be the direction of travel.
The government is in this PR phase when really it needs to be in a detailed phase. And the BBC are lapping it up and patronising us with, you know, now children, the foreign minister's about to say something very important, so we need to sit quietly and listen to him instead of exposing it for what it is, which is this distraction from them having absolutely no clue about how they're going to get us out of this mess.
Well, to be fair, Norman Smith, BBC senior political correspondent, did actually say ahead of Boris's speech that we weren't really expecting this to take things forward. So at least they did say that.
The exception that proves
it. So anyway, let's go on to our next news item now. If you weren't paying attention at the weekend, you might have missed the dawn of post-Brexit socialism. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell told a Labour Party conference on alternatives models of ownership that renationalising public services would cost absolutely nothing. That's right, water, gas, phones and trains irreversibly back under public ownership at zero cost to the taxpayer. McDonnell later told Sky News it would be cost neutral because you'd be bringing into public ownership an asset. You've not just got an asset, that asset would give you income. Instead of that income going to shareholders, it would come to the taxpayer, if there was any income, of course. So unsurprisingly, the Conservatives and the CBI were titanically unimpressed by this wheeze. But even if you're an enthusiastic Corbynist, does it make sense in the context of Brexit? Ian, first, you, I believe, are a huge McDonnell fan, almost as big a fan of him as I am. Setting aside whether nationalisation is or isn't desirable, is this doable if we get the hard Brexit that Labour seems to be so far endorsing?
I think it is desirable, by the way, in most of these utilities. But the thing is how do you do it? That doesn't surprise me. But I mean, it's a question of how you do it. Now, if he's saying that he's going to do it for free, the core part to me then would be that means you're not going to reimburse existing shareholders. Now, that surely is a bit of a problem. I mean, and it's a problem outside of the EU stuff. The EU stuff isn't really a problem. You can have it in public ownership. You can have it in private ownership. There's no EU rules on... In fact, there's quite explicitly an EU rule that says we will not make a judgment on the manner in which you own stuff as a country. What there needs to be is some kind of sort of competition in the provision of service, which they can get by, and we've talked about before. If you take away a private business from someone and nationalise it without compensating people... Now, there you do run into a problem. You would run into a problem with the EU Charter of Human Rights, which we will presumably at this point be out of. But what we will not be out of is the European Convention on Human Rights, which also guarantees property rights. So that in Strasbourg, which will still be the case under Brexit, we would still have to go to court there as well. There is also something at the World Bank, which I didn't know about, called the International Centre for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. And I think you'd probably get taken to that court as well. So even outside of the EU, there's still this web of legal structures that prevent you acting like Hugo Chavez.
Well, indeed, also a lot of the utilities, the bus I rode here on, I think is operated by a branch of the German railways. You know, there's lots and lots of cases like that where the privatised contractors are state-owned or formerly state-owned arms of foreign governments with which we will need to have treaties which will require us to have some kind of clause that bans any kind of, you know, expropriation. So how are we going to do this while reaching out there and having trade deals with anybody, including the EU? It's obviously not possible. I suppose the one cause of confusion is this thing about franchising, that with the railways, there are franchises that run for a certain amount of time, and at the end of it, you could just say, OK, we're not looking for a new franchisee, we'll just take it back in-house. But that isn't true with electricity and gas, I don't think. So,
not as far as I know.
This is a populist policy. You know, let's get it right. I mean, lots of people want to renationalise the railways. It's not an unpopular policy. Perhaps a lot of them don't remember British Rail, but they do. And I can understand that because in many ways the ticketing structure, the way it is run, seems to make little sense to people, often because it's poorly explained. But it has its big disadvantages. Having said that, I fail to see how renationalising phones and so on is going to make the lives of the kind of people who support Jeremy Corbyn, who are looking for a new way of running this country, better. I think that it is a bit of a, you know, it's a hangover from Labour's past, which John McDonnell has seized upon. I think there will be a job persuading large sections of the public when they come to think about it, that actually it will make their lives better in the way that thinking, you know, investing in the NHS, in the way that building housing, et cetera, all these things which are supposed to be priorities for Labour would.
I completely agree with Ros on that point. What I see this as doing is trying to take us back to a pre-Thatcherite era, you know. It's an interesting issue. For 40 years, nationalisation was, you know, the thing, that the key defining issue, and the debate was between nationalisation and privatisation. But actually, we're back into, and Boris knows this, which is why he's made his entire speech about liberalism, we're back into this sort of 19th century political culture of open v closed. That's where the electorate is now. That's the axis that we now find ourselves on. The parties haven't realigned to that, but the voters absolutely have. And so I think, you know, what the Lexiteers are mistakenly doing is talking about returning us to these pre-Thatcher years. The fact is that, you know, if we Brexit, we probably can't afford to do any of this anyway, because we won't have the growth to pay for it. So I really don't understand where they think they're going to get more of a supporter base from with this. You know, Labour aren't flirting at all with any kind of progressive alliance, which would be a bit of an insurance policy for them. They're just hoping that the Tories fall apart over Brexit, and then Brexit will fall into their court. And I just don't see their route to victory by following this path at all.
So do we think
they're fighting yesterday's war?
So do we think overall that they are looking at these opinion polls in which people say, yeah, renationalise the trade, because I'm pissed off with Southern Railways, and they're over-interpreting what the depth of opinion behind these polls?
No, I think this is a smart electoral strategy to talk about nationalisation. I think that there's almost always been public support for it. There's majority support for it in UKIP, in the Conservative Party membership. It's only the political class which thought it went out of fashion for a few years, but the public never went along with them, and it makes total sense to do it electorally anyway. What I think that there's quite an interesting hint here is about some of the reasons why Labour supports Brexit. And I think we get caught up in that, is it this whole Euroscepticism? I think it just, Brexit allows them to come up with much simpler solutions to things. Now, this policy could be compared, I think, with the one that just came out on animal rights, where they were talking about instantly banning foie gras. Now, it's very hard to ban foie gras in the EU, because the way that the system operates is, if it's okay in one country, it should be okay in yours. So you sort of have to take it. I happen not to particularly like that, because I don't really think the foie gras is morally justifiable in any potential way. Plus, I just prefer pâté from the supermarket. And on that basis, you can see how they're starting to come up with very simplistic policies, very simple policies that you can just say without having to worry about the complication. I might say now that, you know, there is no EU rule on nationalising ownership or something, but you have to have, you know, competition and provision. What that really entails is that you need to go to the Commission and find ways of wriggling out of and into various exemptions to make sure that you can do the policies that you want to do, like a green bank or an investment bank or whatever. And they're not interested in that kind of politics. The politics they want is primary coloured, big sledgehammer, four-word sentence, this is getting done, simple solutions for complicated times. That's the game they're playing. And I suspect that ultimately that's the reason that they want to leave the EU.
So to put it another way, is this John McDonnell, who's thought to be leaning pro-Brexit, basically bringing up this nationalisation policy as an internal thing to say to the majority of Remainers among Labour supporters, but oh no, you can't be in favour of Remain, because we can have nationalisation, we can do all these things only if we leave. So it's an internal thing.
I think he would love to make that argument. I think he struggles with it, because the single market guys in Labour are feeling pretty bullish and pretty confident at the moment, and they will take him on that stuff. I'm not sure that it's that strategic. I think it is just that by virtue of the emotion that he feels towards the subject and the priority he gives it, it is quite indicative of some of the other thoughts that are probably going on in his head to do with Brexit.
Okay, let's move on. As always happens, no sooner had we pressed stop recording on last week's show than something big happened. Last week it was the decision of the pro-Brexit press to attack the financier George Soros for his support of the anti-Brexit organisation Best for Britain. Many people felt their reports crossed the line from criticism into batty conspiracy theory and outright anti-Semitism. The Telegraph opened the batting with George Soros, the man who broke the Bank of England, backing secret plot to thwart Brexit, a story co-authored by by Theresa May's highly successful former advisor, Nick Timothy. You note the sarcasm in my voice there. And we saw another glimpse of the Daily Mail versus Mail on Sunday fratricidal psychodrama, with the Daily paper attacking Soros in vitriolic terms, while its Sunday sibling gave Soros space to explain that he opposes Brexit out of love for Britain and not for some evil supervillain reason. Ian and our producer Andrew Harrison recorded a mini pubcast on the subject earlier in the week. You can find it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. But the story's not going away. So, Naomi, why is the pro-Brexit press so incensed by Soros?
Because he is funding Best for Britain, and Best for Britain are fighting tooth and nail for the right to fight Brexit. And Mail and Telegraph splashes help to intimidate people into not speaking up. And that's one of the biggest problems that Remainers have got right now. You know, MPs mainly talk about a soft Brexit, which would be a disaster. Businesses only really talk about Brexit impact privately, and civil society says almost nothing at all. So all of this stuff they know helps to intimidate people into not speaking up. Soros and his foundations actually have a really proud history of supporting open democratic processes. They support things like education and health and governance and transparency and how organisations are run. And the Brexit fight needs more fuel, and we need to be welcoming funding from all legal sources. But Soros or not, thousands and thousands of people have responded to Best for Britain's crowdfunding platform, because there is this real appetite to fight. And they really believe that Brexit might not happen, because, you know, there is definitely going to be a vote in Parliament. And the negotiation is 2 years long for a reason, because it gives us, as the withdrawing country, the chance to compare emerging terms of exit with what we already have. And it's actually the government that has behaved like an autocratic state, if you like, hiding the truth about the impact on ordinary people, and saying and hiding the truth that staying in actually is a genuine option that we still have up our sleeve. This whole lie about deal or no deal, which they've essentially made up, is an attempt to bounce the country into whatever deal they do manage to come back with, if one at all. So yes, this atmosphere of intimidation, this is why the right-wing press are doing it, because it works and you have a go at Soros, and it makes other people slow to speak up. So our political culture is sort of still very, very toxic as it was really around the referendum and the time of Joe Cox's murder, and we seem to have not really learned any lessons from it, and we need a step change in our political culture.
Roz, so we're talking here headlines about a supposedly secret conspiracy, which wasn't secret at all, really. It's just a publicity campaign, masterminded by a supposedly shadowy, but in fact quite well-known puppet master who hasn't actually has any power, he just has money, who just happens to be of Jewish heritage. This sounds a little anti-Semitic to me, is it?
Well, certainly the papers involved were drawing on what we could call anti-Semitic tropes, which are a bit of a dog whistle to people listening for them. You know, I don't like to accuse anyone of anti-Semitism without adequate proof. Yes, Soros himself, of course, is Jewish. He had to flee during the Second World War. In fact, he ended up at the London School of Economics studying there, where he developed some of his ideas. But so he has first-hand experience of what happens when when states go bad. And that is what Soros does, basically. And it's what people don't like and don't understand, because we're quite comfortable with billionaires donating, for example, Bill Gates, Microsoft, donates huge amounts to fight malaria. And that's all fine.
And billionaires donating to the Leave cause as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is newspaper proprietors supporting.
Yes, yes. But of course, this is what this is donating to countries which are developed countries and believe they've got it right, and they don't need people weighing in from the outside. Soros thinks that actually there's no perfect state of democracy. You have to keep making sure that it's alive and that it's working. And sometimes states can't guarantee that a democracy by themselves will function. That's a valid point of view, you know, and he's been doing this for a long time. I think the first time he started donating was when he during apartheid in South Africa, when he used to fund black students to go to university. He has a long record of this kind of thing, and you could see that as meddling, or you could see that as not relying on the nation state to always get it right.
Well, the interesting thing is that he is the man who broke the Bank of England, who stopped Britain effectively sliding towards joining the euro. Why are the Brexiteers not praising him as a hero? I mean, I must say, lots of other people have made this point. I didn't invent this point, but it's a strange point, isn't it?
It's an irony. An irony.
And, you know, all this stuff that's levelled at them about the accusation that it's undemocratic for him to meddle in this process. But in a democracy, people have the right to have different viewpoints. You know, that's the whole freaking point of a democracy. And most importantly, you know, this democratic process of Brexit isn't over yet. So I'm certainly grateful to him. And I think, as you mentioned on the podcast, he's pledging more and more money the more and more he gets slagged off in the media.
Well, we should be grateful to the Telegraph. Because
Absolutely. Actually,
I mean, he started increasing the donations on the back of their coverage and on that, the Daily Mail and the Sun. Mm-hmm. And Best for Britain are getting a huge amount of attention. They're previously an almost unheard of group with very little money. They've now been heard of and have a lot more money thanks to those front pages. So good on the Telegraph, and please may they keep on going.
Rather like the famous front page of the 15 Tory Some rebels, which made them look like heroes.
Yeah. It's almost like the Telegraph are really shit at this, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, obviously there are other people out there who are supporting sort of democratic causes and so on. Why is it that Soros, on the left as well as the right, is so particularly hated? What's he done that's made him such a hate figure?
Well, he's Jewish.
That's the thing, exactly. What this is our question. What beyond that is there?
He is lefty and he's a liberal, okay? I mean, he obviously funds lots of drug reform stuff and all that. Remember, this is a guy who took the fight to communism. This is not just some sort of, you know, lefty. He believes in the open society. He worked, as you say, when he was at LSE, he was with Karl Popper, and I think Karl Popper was the big influence on him on this stuff. Karl Popper, of course, considered a cold warrior by the right on their side most of the time. You know, there is no basis upon which to have this, apart from that classic idea of, you know, the sort of Stalinist idea of the rootless cosmopolitan, Jewish, financier, international, no connection to a country, trying to subvert its democratic norms. It just, there's only so many times you can tell the same story before, when you tell that story, you think, hang on a minute, there's some kind of faulty wiring in your head that explains why you were motivated to tell it in the first place.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that, I mean, what I would sincerely hope that the Telegraph and so on are telling the truth when they say that they didn't mean any anti-Semitic things by doing all this. But I think it's incumbent upon them to explain what, apart from his racial stroke religious background, is it that makes him such a hate figure? Why are they having a go at him so much? And we haven't, between us, come up with any good reason apart from the obvious and highly regrettable one. So let's hope they explain themselves a bit further.
They should have apologised. I mean, the Telegraph should have apologised that night, certainly the morning after, for the way the front page came across. And I'm sorry, they could have done it while kind of back away and saying, look, we kind of over-egged the pudding on things. We needed a bit more information on some of the stuff about him, you know, interfering in Eastern European countries. They could have done it and they chose not to do it. And I'm afraid they do have to hold their hands up for the fact that they have absolutely failed to live up to the mistakes that they made.
Even Katie Hopkins apologised for using the phrase final solution. Interesting, isn't it? Anyway, one final bit of Brexit news. It's the end of an era, as a beloved Brexit fanzine The Daily Express has been sold to the treacherous Remain shill sheet The Daily Mirror. No more headlines with random words capitalised for emphasis. Will this make any difference? Will The Express be made to change its line on Brexit? What do we think?
Well, the Mirror says it won't. The owners of the Mirror say it won't. Mm-hmm. But they would say that, wouldn't they?
Of course.
Because they have to. It's for me, this is a sign of just how powerful the press still is in this country, despite the, you know, the social media and the impact that has had. If you Google quite a lot of Brexit-related subjects, as I sometimes do, you actually find The Express turning up near the top of the Google results quite a lot of the time. Isn't that extraordinary? Mm. It has a strong impact on the way people have thought about Brexit. It has been a major player. It has had very close links with UKIP, in particular, with people, UKIP staff going back and forward between The Express. I mean, I'm pleased that it's no longer under this control. We'll see how it changes, and that will be very interesting. But for me, it is a sign of just how in thrall we still are to media barons in this country.
Well, the interesting thing is that The Express did actually go New Labour at one point. When it was part of United News for a while under Lord Hollick, Clive Hollick, who was a Labour supporter, it did actually have a period of officially supporting New Labour. Then, of course, it changed hands again that Richard Desmond bought it, and then the next editor took it back to supporting the Conservatives, then UKIP, then the Conservatives again. Just looking at the who's been editing it, Hugh Whitto, for the past 7 years, that's a good innings. His predecessor, I think, served 8 years. Hmm. So what newspaper bosses tend to say, and it's usually true, I think, that they don't interfere in the editor's decisions, but they do choose the editor. So I don't know if you noticed, Trinity Mirror has just swapped editors of the Manchester Evening News, one of its big regional papers. You know, the editors do move on every so often. Presumably, the current editor of The Express will move on sooner or later. That will give them an opportunity to appoint an editor with a particular, who's clearly they will be asking, although they will know already what his views are on politics, on Brexit and everything. And that will be an opportunity to make a change, if they want to the editorial line. They could, of course, take a strictly business view and reckon that, you know, the current editorial line of The Express, maintaining that is good for business. And the reason they could do that, in my view, is that the Daily Star comes packaged with this deal. The Daily Star was set up by the Express Group in the 70s to take on the Mirror and the Sun. Now that the Mirror owns it, the obvious thing to do, and if they want to save costs, is to gently fold the Star into the Mirror, and in the meantime, perhaps just run all the Mirror's copy and so on. The Star doesn't do overt politics; it does a bit of populism, but doesn't do overt. That's a big way to save a lot of money fairly quickly, is to fold the Star into the Mirror, and then you don't have to save so much money. You can make the combined Mirror and Express group fairly profitable, and if serving a certain part of the audience with the current sort of Express fare is profitable, then that's a good business strategy, I suppose.
I don't see any reason why they would change what's going on at the Express. I mean, it serves its audience pretty well. The trouble is, of course, that it's competing for that audience with the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail is much, much better at serving that audience. It speaks to it with a much more intuitive sense of what's going on. It's a higher standard of copy. It actually bothers to break stories, no matter what else we think about it. And the Express is obviously always, always the poorer cousin of the two. So there's a bit of an issue there, but it still has got enough of an audience to keep on doing what it is doing. It has been bonkers. I mean, over Brexit, it's been, you know, reliably bonkers. There are no targets which are too low for them. I mean, they've even went for me. I had plenty of dinners where they keep on sending me texts going, "We're about to publish a story saying that you called on people to kill Nigel Farage or something." Some weird thing I said. I mean, they basically watch every time that there's a Remainer on telly, they'll watch it and try and find the worst possible interpretation or misinterpretation of what got said in order to go with it. So, I mean, they really are. They're pretty far out there. You know, that is a relatively successful web operation for the basic SEO reasons, for the Google reasons, the Google ranking reasons. In terms of the paper, I don't see any reason why they would change that. It's a small operation, but it is doing its job.
This week's show is brought to you with the support of ShipStation, the genius shipping software that helps you get ship done. Do you sell online, on eBay, Amazon, or Magento? Then you need ShipStation. It's the fast and easy way to manage and dispatch your orders, all from one place. ShipStation brings all your orders from over 60 popular selling channels into one place, making them really easy to manage from any device, even your mobile phone. It lets you set and forget your shipping parameters so you don't have to enter them over and over again for different stores. It's web-based, so you don't have to mess about with software downloads and installation. And you can use ShipStation to compare rates from top couriers including Royal Mail, FedEx, DHL and UPS. Whether you have one or hundreds of orders, ShipStation makes it easy to batch and print labels so you can get orders out quickly and keep your customers happy. Now you can try ShipStation free for 30 days and get a special bonus when you use the promotion code Romaniacs. To get this special promotion, just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Romaniacs. That's ShipStation.com, then enter promotion code Romaniacs. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen.
Now, it's a very exciting week for Ian because we're going to talk tariffs. Most people, not carrots, tariffs. Most people barely understand what trade tariffs are and how they operate, but they're crucial to how we're going to survive after any form of Brexit. Last week, the Conservative think tank Policy Exchange, the one at which Boris Johnson gave his speech on Wednesday, called for the government to scrap all tariffs on imported goods in the event of a no-deal Brexit, to cut the cost of living and also to pressure the EU to give us favourable trade terms. So the time is right to ask, what are tariffs and do they matter, Ian?
They are a tax on goods coming into your territory, and that territory could be your country or it could be your customs union. That is what a tariff is. It is basically just a tax on things coming into your territory.
And what's the government's position on tariffs now? I mean, we know... They say that they've got these great plans for after Brexit. Policy Exchange, obviously very close to the government, where Boris gave his speech this week. Has the government itself said anything like what Policy Exchange has said about how we plan to change to cut tariffs after Brexit?
Well, not quite. I mean, there was Daniel Hannan set up. Daniel Hannan is the sort of Brexiting Tory MEP who's a big fan of let's get rid of all the tariffs. When he set up his institute, which is now not allowed to be called an institute, has to be called something else, Warbling Nonsense Organisation of England, that was set up, actually, I think, in the Foreign Office. I mean, it was right there and right next to sort of Liam Fox and Boris Johnson, which is about as much of a governmental stamp of approval as you could possibly get. The Legatum Institute, another one, basically is probably the most influential think tank with the government, used to be Policy Exchange, I think probably it now is Legatum, again, has the same sort of ideas. And their attitude would be this. It basically says, fine, if we want to leave the customs union, that means that tariffs would go up because EU would treat us like anyone else. If they're going to do that, then we would just say, fine, we're going to have 0% tariffs on everything with the EU, and that way we can keep what we've got right now, and we'll dare them to do the same. Now, this does not work for a very simple reason, which is called most favoured nation. Most favoured nation is a WTO rule. It basically says that you can't discriminate in your tariffs. So if I say to France, potatoes 10%, then I've got to also say to Cambodia, potatoes are 10%. That's how that works. Unless you have a full free trade agreement. But let's put that to one side. This assumes that we wouldn't have achieved that with the EU. Now, their next point then is that this is okay. But it isn't okay. Because by virtue of having 0% with Europe, you then have 0% with everyone all over the world on every good. Now, on a bunch of them, I mean, tariffs have mostly gone down over the years. I mean, they're very low on most things outside of agriculture and some areas of manufacturing. If you happen to work in agriculture or some areas of manufacturing, you are not going to take kindly to a lot of cheap goods, very often subsidized by foreign governments. You look at what Thailand and Brazil do, like, for instance, with sugar, but with various other areas, where they subsidize them. And you would then make British companies completely bankrupt, completely unable to compete at home because of foreign subsidies, not because of anything to do with the free market. So this is their great big Thatcherism 2.0 Viagra capitalism project of just opening Britain up to the chill winds of globalization. This is what they want to do with it. This is why they essentially, I think, want to hijack Brexit, because whatever else we can say about the vote, it was not a vote for there to be more globalization. Mm. That just wasn't what it was. Quite the opposite. And that, I think, is the big idea behind what Policy Exchange put out. And I do think that that's probably what most ministers, especially the Liam Foxes and the Boris Johnsons of the world, are quite sympathetic towards.
I noticed that in the Policy Exchange report, they do what scriptwriters called lampshading of the big one of the big objections to their policy, which is where you point something out and you move on, basically. One of the big objections, among many, is if you say, right, no tariffs, we're going to get rid of all our tariffs, how do you then negotiate access to other people's markets? Exactly. Because you've given everything away. And they just sort of hand wave at this and say, oh, well, you know, history has shown that, you know, countries that are liberal with their trade tend to get by and tend to do decent trade deals in the end. But the point is, it's all down to the timing of it. There's a big difference between scrapping all of your tariffs and having nothing left to negotiate, which is, to me, even as an ardent free trader such as myself, is crazy. And on the other hand, going into the trade talks saying we are prepared to be very liberal. We are prepared. If you want to do a deal in which you cut your tariffs by 90%, we'll cut ours by 95%. How about that? You know, you could be a little more liberal than your counterparty, but you need to do that as you go into the talks and to be generally get yourself a reputation for being prepared to knock down your own barriers. You don't just knock them all down.
There's even a point where they basically say that reciprocal tariff concessions don't really exist in the real world, where they sort of say that there's been no negotiations where people gradually knock down their tariffs. And you think, yes, they fucking have. Like, that's basically how all trade negotiations work. Now, often that's a really sloppy process where they sit around doing nothing for years and then someone puts a deadline on the end of it and suddenly there's a conversation between, you know, usually the two guys at the top who suddenly start shouting numbers at each other and through this quite emotional, you know, very, very, very cack-handed process, you suddenly get different tariffs. But that is reciprocal negotiations on tariffs. That's how that happens. What you don't get is someone going, I am now going to reduce all of my tariffs to zero. Please, would you give me the thing that I would otherwise have to negotiate with you, even though I've given you everything that you want? It is tantamount to just leaving your house, giving all the keys to someone, signing over all of the ownership via a solicitor, and then sending them an email 2 years later and going, oh, sorry, mate, you wouldn't mind paying me the money. So you've given up all of your advantages.
Indeed. I mean, it seems to me, looking at it as a conservative supporting free trader, their argument for sort of ultimate free trade, cutting all of our tariffs, would be a lot more respectable, but for the fact that you mentioned earlier, which is that other countries are incredibly illiberal and have all these subsidies and populist programs and so on. If every other country were a free trader, and you know that we knew that, that it wasn't an explicit plan to wipe out our industry, which it often is, particularly in the case of the Chinese. They are determined to have their steel industry still standing when nobody else is.
So that
doesn't make it a particularly conservative or free market argument to in those circumstances, it seems to me.
Exactly. We're throwing away what our country has sought to achieve for centuries, ignoring the fact that the EU provides us greater access to trade with and beyond Europe through strength in numbers and things like that. And you know, our foreign policy over the last 100 years has largely been about making sure we had the freest possible trade with our nearest neighbours and ensuring that no one state in Europe ever had too much of a dominant role. And, you know, of course, we've switched sides throughout that time to achieve that end, which the Brexiteers now seem hell-bent on trying to destroy. I just think we have to laugh at these people because they don't know how to promote trade. This is all about romanticism and ignoring the fact that free trade wasn't just about economics, but the extent to which we were open or closed. You know, tariffs are part of the mix, but regulatory alignment helps you trade in the 21st century. And I just think that Policy Exchange is completely missing the point on this, because even in their own terms, they're wrong, because the EU really is this vehicle for much more open trade internationally and reducing barriers between countries. And that's before we've had any kind of currency collapse. So yes, under a, you know, sort of tariff-free thing, you know, consumer goods might be cheaper, but if the currency collapses, these goods would have already become 20% more expensive for us anyway, and there are very few goods that have 20% tariffs on them.
And
it's just a nonsense.
And the point is, the whole focus of the report on tariffs sort of deeply neglects the non-tariff barriers, as you've mentioned, that, you know, that the regulatory standards, all the other stuff, things like having border checks at all, the need for border checks, having to pay VAT up front, and all those sorts of things that if you don't have a deep trade deal with the European Union are going to be huge problems, and you know they're going to swamp any effect from reducing tariffs. It seems to me.
And what's the old adage that if goods can't cross borders, soldiers do? You know, the European Union is a peace project for a reason.
In the adult world, where this shit actually has to get dealt with, rather than us just pretending that everything's going to be some fairyland of free trade, we need to start sorting this stuff out now, because we're supposed to be negotiating the third-party deals. This is the geekery that you're never allowed to talk about anywhere, but I have you people trapped in this room, and so it's coming out.
The door's locked.
Right, indeed.
Take your headphones out, listeners.
with places like Canada and South Korea. And now there, it's not just the tariffs that you're dealing with, but something really quite genuinely, numbingly boring called tariff rate quotas, which is where you start taking in a certain amount of stuff, a certain amount of tons of dairy or cheese or something for a certain amount, and then anything beyond that is another number. Now, that is a massive problem, because there you can't replicate the EU's tariffs. You can't just copy and paste them. It's a slice of the pie. You have to work out how much of this product from South Korea goes to the UK, how much of it, you know, goes to the rest of Europe. That is a massive logistical exercise that should have to be done by March 30th, 2019, which doesn't give us an awful lot of time, given that most of our capacity, of course, is dedicated towards the Brexit negotiations. Now, there is a bit that the British government, not many people notice this, but actually put out a bit the other day, sort of going, by the way, legally, if the rest of the world could just treat us like an EU member state during transition, that would be great. Because really what that is just saying, please don't make us renegotiate this stuff. Now, just months ago in October, Liam Fox was in front of the Conservative conference going on that, oh, we can get all of these deals done, it's a load of old nonsense, people don't have enough faith in me. Now he has been chucked into an attic. They basically put his department into special measures, put out this plea to the rest of the world going, please, please don't hold us to any of this stuff and just pretend that we're something that we're actually frankly not, i.e. Brexit does not mean Brexit. That is literally the new government position. And that is their way to get past it. When we talk about tariffs, the reality of tariffs, what they are like to negotiate, that is the fiendish, devilish complexity of the thing, which will suck up your negotiating capacity. It is not just this Mickey Mouse world of saying, fine, nothing, off we go, and if a few farmers lose their jobs, then that's none of our concern.
Okay, just to wrap this section up, assuming that we have to go through with Brexit and the government needs to be doing stuff now, what should it be doing now on tariffs, Ian?
Well, it should keep everything as much as it can as it is. You try to stay in a customs union so that you have no tariffs within your largest market. That means that you can't really impact anything with the rest of the world, apart from if the EU does a deal. With the tariff rate quotas, you go to the WTO, you leave it to the techies, you basically say, look, in a joint thing with the EU, and you say, look, we're going to take the last 3 years' trading levels, and we're going to take that as our precedent for how we separate the stuff out. If you really have to go that way, you know, ideally you'd stay in a customs union, that wouldn't be a problem. You basically buy time. You make sure that you have enough space to make these decisions and you have enough negotiating capacity to do them. You don't get very emotional and nationalistic and chest thumping and say we can do everything all at the same time. It will all be fine. It absolutely will not. You dot your I's and you cross your T's. And if you are going to make changes, you do it to a realistic timetable to deliverable political goals. The kind of thing that the British government used to do without having to be instructed. But that is no longer the case.
Indeed. All very sensible, therefore, will never happen. So, finally, in an attempt to lighten the mood, we had so much fun last week with our Brexiter or Romaniac slot that we're going to do it again. The idea is that I throw out some famous fictional names and the panel have to decide if each one would be a Remainer or a Leaver. This week, it's the turn of famous villains. Are you ready? Starting with Blofeld from the James Bond films. Remainer or Leaver?
Here's a rule. We're not allowing ourselves to make all the baddies Leavers. Because
okay.
We don't like Leavers.
Okay.
But have a go. Obviously, do international supervillains like open markets or fragmented markets with lots of borders and opportunities for smuggling and corruption? Yes. Okay. Magneto from the X-Men, which is some sort of comic thing, apparently.
Whoa, fuck me. That is interesting. I think you've got to... He's Remain, because ultimately he's going to have a quite sophisticated thing of the kind of prejudice that gets expressed towards people. He would probably have some kind of sympathy. I'm looking at our producer, Andrew, who's as much of a comics geek as me, as his eyes bore down on me. He's going to have the kind of sympathy, you know, with immigrants that you would expect from the general prejudice against mutant kind. He'd be very aware of overmighty national state government. I think Magneto comes down on Remain. He grew up in a concentration camp.
Francis Urquhart from House of Cards original series.
Ooh.
I reckon Remainer.
Yeah, I think so too.
Doesn't like to rock the boat. Establishment that's dominating Britain or something like that, is it?
Exactly. Peter Mandelson, you know. Yes. We haven't heard much from Peter recently, but let's face it, he's a Remainer.
Okay. Voldemort from Harry Potter.
Which one is that? Is that the one with the funny nose?
It's the evil one, Ian.
The one with the
one
he's got no nose.
The one who,
Ray Fiennes, yeah. I don't know, fuck knows.
Well, he does have an obsession with blood purity. There you go. So maybe possibly a little tiny bit Levy. Okay, the Master from Doctor Who, male and female versions.
He's got, because he's quite chaotic, isn't he? He'd want to cause chaos and stuff. He'd probably be Brexit vote, just on the let's shit things up a bit.
Yeah, he's like a Russian bot, yeah.
But he is a rootless cosmopolitan.
Yeah, so rootless in time and space,
yeah,
I suppose.
So he might be a Remainer. Mr. Hyde from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Boris Johnson, the night he had to write that article deciding whether he would back Remain or leave, he drank the potion and became Mr. Hyde. There you go. Ben Kingsley is Don Logan in Sexy Beast, something I have never seen.
Well, you should, because it is absolutely fantastic, yep. And he's one of the greatest bad guys I've ever seen, specifically, I think. That guy is leave. I mean, really, you'd be hard-pushed to find someone more leavey than that. Red-faced with outrage over the status of the modern world and the fact that he has to listen to foreign accents all the time, desperate to leave Europe, and he wants a return of smoking on planes. So he's a total leaver.
But would he then get an Irish passport and stay on the Costa del Grime? Being a hypocrite.
It's possible.
So finally, my personal favourite all-time villain, Dick Dastardly from The Wacky Races.
I have absolutely no idea.
Well, probably a bit of a Jeremy Clarkson figure, like Cars, so probably a Remainer, a surprising Remainer maybe.
Well, there is actually that long-lost episode in which he paints a slogan on the side of the 00, his car, that says, there'll be £350 million for the NHS if I win the race. I think that's a clue.
And then it goes over the cliff edge.
Exactly. Right? Yes. Yeah. And I think also Muttley is the secret Remainer, the Philip Hammond of The Wacky Races, who's constantly foiling Dick Dastardly's evil schemes. Yes. And the good thing is, Dick Dastardly never won. That's our sign for hope, that, you know, he kept trying and trying and trying, but never won. Anyway,
That's the end of the show. Thanks to Naomi, Roz and Ian. By the time you hear our next show, we'll have done our first Romaniacs Live and we'll be all travelling in separate limousines and no longer talking to one another. Ticket holders, we'll see you at the Phoenix Cavendish Square in central London on Thursday. For this week's Eurolanguage sign-off, we'll have another rock and roll Romaniac. This is Peredur Ap Gwynedd of the drum and bass band Pendulum with a bit of Welsh for you.
Wow. Oedd Al Green yn iawn. Gadewch ni aros gyda'n gilydd.
Playing us out, as ever, it's Corner Shop with Demon is a Monster, our theme tune. Hold tight for shout-outs to our loyal Patreon supporters.
It's huge Romaniac love to Andy Hunter, Stuart Armstrong, Torsten Komarek and Steve Smith.
And thanks from me to Lord Kern, Rosa, just Rosa, possibly Rosa Luxemburg, Nicholas Ashton and Jonathan Carmichael.
Hello, and thank you to Bart Crisp. Didn't I have him at a party the other day? Haridos Apostolides, Rob Townsend and Karina Cellis.
And finally, thanks from me to John Davey, Anna Hopp, Richard Latham and Jules Berner. We're back next week.
Romaniacs was presented by Peter Collins with Naomi Smith, Ross Taylor and Ian Dunt. Studio production was by Jack Claremont and the producer was me, Andrew Harrison. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.